The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So Cheryl asked me to talk about why do we allow people to come in late?
Yeah. For the effect of it and so on. Yes, somebody asked me tonight.
Not sure exactly where to start with that, but, you know, we are a kind of urban, more or less urban, community meditation center where people have... Oh, you can't trouble hearing. Is people okay hearing? Out in the outer hall, people okay? I think you need to get the hearing assistant devices. So... Everyone okay? So the question is about the coming late. So here in this, you know, the assumption I have is that most people have busy lives around here. It's a challenge to make a livelihood, to work. Lots of demands on people. Some people have a family and other obligations. And this kind of lifestyle that many people live, it's often difficult to be able to come to, even to meditate, let alone come to meditation center. And we're meant to be a resource for the community where people can come and practice. And so the idea is to keep the doors open and not have a, you know, if you don't come by 7:30, we lock the doors. The assumption is people are doing their best effort. It's good for people to come on time. It helps everybody else to have a place that's quiet. But we don't want to make just a strict requirement of that because we want people to feel comfortable coming here late if that's what they have to do. We're hoping that people don't come late just casually, just because, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, whatever. But we want people to feel comfortable coming when they can and to leave when they can. So coming and going out of IMC is supposed to be real easy. And it's kind of, also partly it's a spirit of expressing the tremendous openness that I think the Dharma has always been offered. Dharma is offered freely and openly to everyone. The Dharma is offered... without any obligation to anyone. And that's kind of the spirit of the heart, is to have that kind of openness and receptivity and availability to everyone. And so some people have said that it's quite unusual for them to come to IMC because it's one of the few places in public people can go where nothing's asked of them. In the sense, you know, I mean, you can go to the park, I guess, but you know, you come into a building, institution, and lots of people, and no one's at the door asking for money, no one's at the door checking your badge, you know, or anything, you just come. And some people find that very meaningful and very to come in very safe and comfortable. They love sitting in the back row for years and not talking to anybody. And some people find it comfortable coming right up front, except some people. And so that's kind of the idea. Is that the kind of what you had in mind?
I think that's what the person was asking. Yeah. And what about the practice? Maybe a little bit about the practice for those who have to listen to some rustling or this or that.
Well, yeah. The other thing is that, I mean, part of the practice of mindfulness of Dharma is you know, the essence of Dharma practice is not to cling and not to get attached to things. And so one of the things we can get easily attached to is my precious practice, my stillness. To be spiritually mature in our tradition is to be interruptible. Whereas you don't like, oh no, you know, keep that at bay, or that shouldn't be happening. But rather there's something very maturing and very wise about learning to whatever sounds, whatever activities are going on within reason, to include them within your meditation, don't make it a problem. And it's part of a training, and it's common enough for people who are new to IMC to be a little bit perturbed by all the coming and going and the noise. But most people, after they come for a while, find that it no longer bothers them because they find that they can meditate just fine. And it's actually quite a powerful lesson to learn to keep the attention aware, open, present, and be kind of inclusive of those things rather than exclusive, or rather be troubled by them, to be kind of just to hold them within the field of awareness. So it's part of our practice too. And if we had a really strict policy, you know, lock the door. Like, again, some meditation centers, they close the doors when the meditation is supposed to start. And it's beautiful. It gets really pristinely still and quiet in the meditation hall. And it also promotes discipline in people because, you know, it's consequential if you come late. And so people get a little more disciplined. And there's a lot of good things that way. But one of the things that happens is people get really attached to the silence and the preciousness of it. And they get that to my practice, and they get attached to rules and regulations. There's an inside and outside, and the way it's supposed to be done, and so we practice with how it is here. Given that, sometimes I'm a little bit surprised by people who come in late, and they come in late, and they insist on sitting way over there, you know, and. And there's probably if it's not too easy to slip in here, you should probably sit in, you know, if you're coming in late to the sitting, sit in the outer hall until the end of the sitting. I think that's nice to do. But
thanks. You haven't said much about that for a while.
Well, I prefer not to say about it. But you asked.
Double thank you for doing that.
So should we change gears, or would you? Or is this an opportunity? Or, you know, is this an opportunity to find out about how it works here, what goes on here? I mean, we're kind of mysterious in many ways to people. There's a lot about IMC which is not obvious when you come in, because the underlying philosophy is how we present and what we do here is not spoken much about. So, you know, some people are mystified. What goes on here? How does this happen? And I wonder too. So, yeah, you've been here for a long time. Do you know how it works here?
Some things.
Some days.
Another day, maybe something else. Yeah.
Okay. So, let's do. Should we do a Dharma talk?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I do feel kind of. You know, I don't say this, but one of the things I don't say much about how it works here is that I do find it kind of odd that I sit up here and I carry on these monologues week after week. I mean, you know, in the rest of my life, you know, my friends and stuff, I mean, I can't just start, you know, going on for 45 minutes. And then I have this captive audience here. I mean, it's kind of an amazing thing. And you guys are all polite. And so it's, you know, so I am kind of amazed. So it happened that when I came down here to teach, all day today I was thinking, what am I going to teach today? And I had nothing to teach. And I'd kind of felt emptied out of teaching, and like, you know, I've been teaching a lot lately or something, and I had nothing to teach. And I came down here and I drove down, I had nothing, it's nothing there, nothing. You know, I have nothing. And so I thought, well, what I'll do is take questions. That's, you know, that'll be nice, because that's not... And I thought that was good, to take questions. But then I sat. And I knew early in the day, you know, if I had just sat for an hour or two, I'm pretty confident that a talk would come. But I didn't thought that would, I didn't think a talk would come from just sitting this evening. So I was all prepared to do questions. But then I sat, and I started being filled in a beautiful way. I felt very calm. I got somewhat concentrated and focused. And in that calm and focus, I started feeling kind of filled physically in my body, a nice feeling of warmth, delight, of being connected, being here in my body. And in that sense of being full, then a topic for a talk came. So that's what I'll offer today. And it's partly because it's a topic I talked about last Wednesday briefly. And so it's something that I'm interested in. I think it's, I feel some... It's alive for me in a certain way. So I like to try to teach whenever I can something that feels alive and present. And so that wasn't there earlier today. So it might also be interesting for you to hear the background like that. Maybe that's... and so to introduce the topic, I want to say that one of the, you know, great questions for many people and many spiritual traditions is, who are you? And to discover who you are. And if you go to the Zen master and say, well, you know, I'm a plumber, that's who I am, they'll probably throw you out of the room and say, come back tomorrow, because that's not who you really are. You say, well, I'm a parent. Out of the room you go, you know, because that's not a satisfying answer for a Zen master. Who are you really? And then you come back and say something profound, like you say, I'm love. Out you go. And so, who are you? Is an important question. Now, one of the answers that many people will come to, especially if you were the Zen master who kind of rejects everything else, eventually many people come to the answer that I am awareness. That's who I am. And in fact, some religions, that's kind of a central tenet, that who you really are, the true self, has to do is consciousness or awareness. Buddhism has a different view on this, but Buddhism also puts a lot of emphasis on the value and importance of awareness. And mindfulness is kind of a form of awareness. And so we practice an awareness practice. We practice mindfulness. And awareness is really a beautiful and profound thing that's often overlooked. It's very easy to get involved in life and be so concerned with the many important things and trivial things that people can be involved in and get preoccupied and get so focused and fixated on work and family and all the things we have to do, that in that preoccupation with what we can think about or be concerned about, we don't really notice that we are being aware. And of course, if someone says, are you aware? You say, I'm aware, yes. You know, you kind of know. But it's not like alive in a juicy way. It's like, wow, there's awareness here. There's attention. This is an amazing phenomenon. To be aware. I mean, how does that work? How does that happen in this human life? You know, it was very meaningful for me many years ago when the idea of my awareness was reframed by someone, maybe like Alan Watts, who said, human awareness, human consciousness, is the way the universe looks at itself. So usually we might think of awareness as, I'm the one who's aware. It's my awareness and I'm aware of the world. But if you kind of see that human life evolves out of the planet, out of the stuff of the universe, and we're part and parcel of the universe, it's who we are, and we're an aspect of nature, of the universe, but we're definitely part of it, then in this amazing evolution and growth from stardust to planets to life to human beings to animals that are conscious and sentient, that one way of seeing it is that it's not about you as an individual, but it's about, here it is, it's the universe is conscious of itself through you in a certain kind of way. So that was very meaningful to me many years ago when I read that. So what is awareness? And it turns out that awareness is not an easy thing to define. Awareness has no shape. It has no weight. It has no color. It has none of the kind of conventional ways in which we would describe a thing. And since it's not a thing in the ordinary senses of the term thing, like a physical, material thing, how do you describe something which is, in some ways, invisible? I mean, you can be aware of it, of being aware, but can you see awareness? Can you hear it? Can you smell it? Can you taste it? Can you touch it? I don't know if you can really say no, but you can't say yes, because awareness is kind of the medium through which you know all those things. But what is it? And is it a singular thing? So we know, some of us know, if you read modern kind of scientific or neurobiological efforts to try to define consciousness, they're having a hard time with this. I mean, some books are very clear, this is what it is, but then another book says this is what it is. You know, they can't quite agree. It's kind of a little bit of a mystery. And they're trying to figure out neurology and the brain waves and how they function and how human consciousness arises. But one of the things that's coming, it seems to be appearing as people do this neurobiology studies, is that what we think of as consciousness is a variety of mental processes operating together in harmony. Whereas if you really are acutely aware of awareness, of being paying attention, the function of attention, of being conscious, it can feel like a unitary thing. It can feel like it's a singular thing to be conscious, my consciousness. And it can be so powerful that in certain settings, the idea of consciousness that's bigger and larger than anything else, more that it, you know, seems like it's one of the most, you know, really, you know, it's really clear that this is a thing, a unitary thing. But then if there's a variety of things that go wrong in the brain, and those mental processes don't function just right, all kinds of wacky things happens with consciousness for people. And we start seeing that it's not a unitary thing, but it's made up of many different aspects that come together in a certain kind of harmony. So if it's not a unitary thing, what is it? From the Buddhist point of view, we don't necessarily ask, you know, the neurobiology of awareness, of consciousness, but we are interested in the what's called the phenomenology of it, how it's experienced. And some people have no interest because they're more interested in the things of the world, but it's fascinating to step back because it's probably one of the most intimate things you'll ever know, your awareness. What's closer to you than awareness? And so how is that experienced? And people who meditate discover at some point in meditation, it's not automatically, but at some point as you get concentrated and settled, discover something very interesting about awareness, and that is that awareness is a fluid phenomenon, how it's experienced. So, for example, as people get calm and relaxed, awareness, the sense of awareness or consciousness, or sometimes people use the word mind almost synonymously, becomes expansive. People talk about big mind sometimes, or an expansive mind, or a wide mind. And it feels as if the awareness is extends beyond the boundaries of your body, because you just feel so spacious and open. And now, is awareness really extending beyond the body? I don't know if it really does. I don't know if it's important to know whether it does, but it can feel that way. Because awareness not being a thing, it doesn't have a shape, has no essential boundaries of its own. And so the sense of boundaries, the sense of, you know, is quite variable, and that can be part of the construct of the mind. What the mind does and how it participates in the shaping of a consciousness. And when the mind is relaxed and concentrated, then the tendency is that it doesn't, not involved in defining things so much anymore, labeling things, labeling self, labeling others, being ideas. And as the ideas of the mind relax, then there's a sense of a boundary to the body also dissolves a little bit, and awareness seems to extend wider. And then there's a wonderful feeling some people can have, that awareness is actually as extends as widely away from you as the thing it is that you're aware of. So if there's a sound, the car travel going by outside, then the you know, in a certain kind of way, you can feel like, well, awareness is wide enough to take that in. And you can kind of, the experiential sense is that awareness is really so big. It's as big as this building, as big as the city. It takes in whatever it's aware of, whatever comes into awareness. But is that really what's going on? I think that nowadays people think, no, that it's the sound from the car outside that's traveling through the airwaves and hitting my eardrums and then being processed by the brain. The experience of the car is happening in the mental processing. It isn't that the awareness goes out there, but still, the experience of the car is happening within awareness. So one of the kind of mind-changing kind of questions that some people like to ask is, are you inside this room, or is the room inside of you? You know, of course you're inside the room, but how do you know you're inside this room? The knowing of the room and you inside the room is all happening within the processing that's happening in the mind. Outside of the processing in the mind, you don't know, there is no room in a certain kind of way. There is a room, of course, but and it's a little bit arbitrary how, slightly arbitrary, how we reconstruct the external world. And that can shift and change depending on a variety of things. So as people meditate, people have the experience of the mind getting quite, sometimes quite big and expansive, relaxed, open. And it's a beautiful feeling because of how peaceful it can be. And then, with that perspective of experiencing that, then it's possible to also to be aware of the opposite of that. You can be sitting, meditating, feeling relaxed, minding your own business. But unfortunately, your mind has a mind of its own. So you're sitting there, and you know, 0 to 60 in the mind can be like an instant between not thinking and spiraling out of control in thought. And so you can have, so say that they hear the car outside, and this deep rumble of that kind of car reminds you of someone who had some kind of low rumbling car 30 years ago that crashed into you. And suddenly you're thinking about that accident, and you're thinking about the injustice of it, and the problems of it, and how your life would have been different. And you're kind of suddenly you're involved in that all that story and drama of that accident and what happened. And then you notice, you pay attention to experientially what just happened to you. And what happened to your sense of awareness. And some people can then, because the mind was so relaxed and open, it becomes, you can really feel how it all gets tight and constricted and contracted. And the field of awareness is no longer wide and open. It's now gotten very, very narrow. The field of awareness is limited to those concerns. If you relax, and often it takes relaxing, taking a deep breath, and you're not so riding so close in on the thoughts and the concerns or your emotions and feelings, then you can get kind of feeling some space that gets created in awareness again, some space in the mind, and it begins opening up again. And to watch that movement is a fascinating movement. And to notice when you feel, you know, and sometimes some people report when the mind gets really preoccupied around some concerns, they say, even say there's kind of a darkening that happens in the mind. Whereas when the mind is relaxed and open and spacious, it feels very light, luminous almost, a certain kind of quality. And so awareness can feel very small and tight, and so much so that it gets lost. We're not even aware that we're aware because we're so concerned with what we have to take care of. Or awareness can be very broad and expansive, so big and strong and wide that it seems to be more valuable, more meaningful than the things that can happen within the field of awareness. And it's quite something to have all this. It's like, you know, if you go, I don't know where, but if you go like to some place in nature, let's say the beach, and it's a beautiful day where the ocean is really expansive and quiet and peaceful, and it's a long beach, expansive beach. And in that great space, expansive space, someone perhaps, you know, you could see something on the beach, maybe walking down the beach, and you're much more relaxed and open and can hold that in a very spacious way. And it feels so good to hold it in that spacious way. It feels so good not to, you know, be caught up in the details of life. Whereas if you're stressed out in daily life, the details of life can be so preoccupying. And so there's something about the spaciousness and the peace and the openness of an open mind that feels so valuable that it's sometimes easy to just let a thought or pass through the mind and not get involved in it. Not to dismiss it, but it's like something else. There's another very valuable thing going on. Just being aware, the peacefulness of awareness. So just let it go by. You don't pick it up. And this is for meditators, it's a beautiful thing to learn that you don't have to pick up all your thoughts. You don't have to react to them. You don't have to get caught by them. You don't have to be pushed around by them. And it's a lot easier to do that when the mind has this open, spacious quality. So the mind or awareness can be small and tight. It can be quite expansive. Awareness also can be changed in other ways. You can direct your awareness. You can, you know, decide to pay attention to your left hand, Some of you, I'm sure, have not been thinking about your toes for the last few minutes. And I could suggest to you, feel your toes. And you can, suddenly your attention is directed to your toes and you start becoming aware of your toes. And so awareness is something that can be directed. But it's also something that can be receptive. It can be like an open, very open, like a something. It's very open. And rather than directing yourself to listen to the sounds outside, in that openness, the sounds come to awareness. And you're just as aware of the sound as if you paid attention to it directly, directed in a directed way, but the mind is not working to pay attention. Attention just happens. So awareness is something we can actively try to do, and it's also something we can passively allow to happen. Another great exercise to try to do is to receive the instructions. I'll give it to you now. So listen to this and do. I expect you to do a good job. Stop being aware. Stop it, you guys. Just cut it out. And if I give you that instruction, most people find it's really hard to stop being aware. I mean, it's like that. Then you're so aware, and during the meditation, you were struggling to be aware. But when you're told to stop being aware, it's just like then it's pretty easy. Awareness is what the mind does. The mind is, in a sense, an awareness process. And if you're relaxed, awareness can just happen. It doesn't have to be directed. It can just be receptive in all directions, 360 degrees. Awareness also can be very focused. And you can take, it's like taking a close-up lens, you can get, or like a microscope, and you can get really close and precise with awareness attention and look very precisely, and everything else falls away. You don't notice because you're so absorbed in something very small. Or you can take a wide-angle lens and make the awareness like a wide-angle lens, or step back and take a bird's-eye view, or look at things from a distance. I've known people have done this with emotions. Some emotions can be quite difficult to be with, and sometimes we ride our emotions very carefully and very concerned about them. And some people find it very helpful to step back and take a bird's-eye view or get a very wide space. Imagine that the awareness is as big as all of Redwood City. And they say, oh, then I can hold the emotion. But if I'm riding it close, there's no space, and it's claustrophobic, or we get pushed around. Or sometimes with a difficult emotion, sometimes it's really useful to actually go into it and put awareness right in the middle of it and really feel it from the inside very closely and intimately. And then something very different happens. Something releases and opens or evolves. So this awareness thing, it can shift and change and morph. You can do many things with it. And maybe because it's not a thing. It's certainly a process, but it's not a thing like we usually think of. So some people take awareness to be ultimate, and that's, this is who I am. And it's very interesting to look at what happens to the other ideas of who we are, who we think we are, when awareness is very open and relaxed and spacious. Are you the parent? Are you the plumber? Are you the victim? Are you the angry person? Are you the old person? Are you whatever? What are you? And you can see that the thought is there and has some accuracy, some of them perhaps, but those ideas, those thoughts, those concepts feel like water painting on a running stream, on a river. It just feels like, it doesn't really, where is it going to land? It has to land somewhere to have any meaning. And if, so like identity, which is maybe obvious, relatively obvious for me, is that I'm a man, right? Male. So I could ride that identity really close and tight and be really concerned that you see me as a good man or whatever, and really kind of get into the man thing. Some of you have known men who do that. But I can sit and be very relaxed and open with my awareness and not readily kind of getting latching on to ideas and concepts. And I could see the thought, Gil's a male, Gil's a man. Just go through. And, you know, I know it has some truth to it. I know which bathroom to go to. when they have, you know, male and female bathrooms. But I know enough, but it just doesn't, you know, there's something much more deeper and more valuable going on. The awareness, the peacefulness of awareness, this openness of awareness is like this beautiful screen. It's like the beautiful running, you know, calm river that's flowing. And the thought of a male just doesn't have much juice to hold on to and to get involved in and get preoccupied with. And so a lot of the ideas, this is who I am, starts seeming like that. It's just, oh, it's an interesting idea, thank you. But it's not really who I am. Because you realize you're more than that. There's more than just your ideas. And ideas are just ideas. They're valuable, they have their place. But this awareness thing is quite something. So then some people will say, awareness is who I really am. That's my true nature. And because one of the, and it helps to have that idea, I mean, one of the things that supports that kind of idea is that everything else can seem to have some kind of impermanence. It's always moving and changing. You know, or just ideas that float by, or everything else seems sooner or later passes and disappears. But awareness seems to be a constant. It doesn't change at all. It's kind of permanent. It's like the backdrop. It's a background. Background field is the background screen. The screen's always there, even though what's being projected on the screen is always changing. So it can feel that way. But the fact that it feels that way, does that mean that it really is that way? Is the way you experience things an accurate view of what's really happening? If the way we experience awareness is that it's unitary, and it turns out to be made up of many different processes, is it unitary or is it many processes? What is it? The fact that we can experience awareness being so wide that we take in the street outside and the cars going out, like, as if it's that wide, is that really what's going on, or is it that the sound waves are coming to us and we process it in the brain? So the fact that we can experience awareness as being constant and permanent, kind of always there, ever there, is that really the case? Is it really that way? You know, if you take a flame, like on a stick, this is an ancient Buddhist kind of metaphor or simile. If you take a flame on a stick, and nowadays you use glow sticks maybe, and you spin it around really fast in a big circle in the dark, then it looks like it's a ring of fire. It's one continuous full ring. Because that's what the eyes kind of blend it all together, right? When we process it, that it constructs a ring because it goes so fast. But we know that the flame can only be in one place at a time. So it's not really a continuous ring, but it looks continuous. So could it be that the continuous permanent feeling of awareness is like that? Could it be? Is that what's going on? How do we know? Or another perspective is that generally when people have this very big, open, spacious, relaxed awareness that really gives a strong sense of all that really is awareness. Awareness is the most, you know, central thing. It's a permanent thing. Awareness in some ways takes the shape of what it focuses on sometimes, if it's really focused on something. And if awareness is focused on empty space because it's so spacious, then maybe, you know, since we can't know empty space without being aware of it, then, you know, there's a kind of intimate connection between awareness and the empty space. And so the empty space has this quality of feeling like it's permanent, right? I mean, where does it go? Does it come from anywhere? Does it go anywhere? What is this permanent space? It's an empty space. It's always there, isn't it? Kind of. And so if awareness takes in that, really takes that in, awareness can also feel like it's permanent and doesn't go anywhere, doesn't come from anywhere, doesn't go anywhere. But is that really the case? Do we know? And how do we answer this question? Can we answer this question? There are the way that I know that this question can be answered in a way that was meaningful for me, because I at some point in my meditation practice, I felt that everything was impermanent. It was really clear, everything except for awareness. And I went to my teacher and said, I don't think I can be a Buddhist. I think I need to become a Hindu. Because in certain Hindu traditions, they have the idea that consciousness, pure consciousness, is the ultimate. And the self, who the true self is consciousness awareness. So that's everything's a permanent. This thing doesn't change. And my teacher said to me, Gil, just keep looking. Which is like, you know, the fundamental teacher's instruction. You come to me with a profound question, and I just look at you and say, oh, good. Just keep looking. It's very easy to be a teacher. And so I did. And I kept practicing and practicing. And then at some point, awareness dropped away. It's like the floor just dropped away. And it was one of the most beautiful things I ever experienced. But how do you experience something where there's no awareness? So this is kind of, you know, it gets kind of Escher-like or something. And but to see or to know or to experience awareness drop away and then return shows you that awareness is not a constant. But in Buddhism, it isn't so important whether you believe that awareness is constant or you believe that it's inconstant. It's not so important if you believe awareness is unconditioned or the ultimate or whether it's not the ultimate. At least from my point of view, what I understand so far, is what's most important is that what it teaches you is not to cling. And one of the things you not to cling to is awareness itself. And it's the freedom of not clinging that this practice is pointing to. And we use our awareness in the service of that. We use our awareness to see clearly what's happening here, to see clearly what's happening in our present experience, to see how we function and operate, how we think, how we feel, how we relate to the world. We use our awareness to understand and be present for the world in a deeper, fuller way so compassion can arise and empathy can arise. We use our awareness to understand attachment and clinging and how that operates so that we can be wise about it. We use awareness to overcome our delusions, our confusions. And we use awareness to help us see how we can move towards more and more freedom, the freedom from clinging, move towards peace. And there's no peace found in clinging to anything, including awareness. But to have the experience of not clinging to anything whatsoever is a powerful lesson in our heart's capacity for being at peace. We have these really beautiful hearts that have a phenomenal potential and capacity for deep, abiding peace. And that's kind of what this practice is pointing to. And in that peace, in that, you know, freedom, then there can arise our response, our responding, our acting in the world. And one of the very, I think, meaningful things to discover is how to be deeply relaxed, not to be at peace, and then to allow a response to the world arise within us that's not a reaction to the world, but rather a deep upwelling of our compassion, our love, our wisdom that arises. And so, to a small degree, that's what I did this evening. I came here with nothing on my mind, and I wasn't concerned particularly about that. And then I sat, and then something in my... I got, it was peaceful and relaxed. It was very nice to sit here with you. And in that, something arose. And I told you this. And you can decide whether this was worthwhile for arising a phenomena. And if it was not worthwhile to have this come out of my mouth today and you felt like you're a captive audience, then I apologize. And whatever I said that was foolish today, you can leave here when you leave. Don't take it with you. So, thank you.